Hey everybody, my name's Matt. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Blake, for the introduction, and thank you, Don, for the invitation, and the committee, thank you for putting this thing together. It's been an amazing weekend, and all of the speakers have just lifted me up. I feel like my job is somewhat easy this morning because of the path that's been laid before me, and I'm just incredibly grateful to be here. I mean, I was not planning to be sober on this day, August 20th, 2023. Certainly didn't seem like my ideal of fun this weekend. When I, prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and meeting you fine people, I was quite all right burning my life to the ground. If you just leave me alone, I would have been okay just not waking up, but for some reason I always did. And I didn't know what that reason was at the time, but I'd like to believe that we've talked about it this weekend, and it's on the wall behind me. And it's what keeps me going. I hope if nothing else that I can splash some of that onto you this morning, because it surely has been splashed onto me. My sobriety date's May 1st of 2008. I have a home group. Kickoff isn't until noon. We meet Sunday morning at 8 in Franklin, Tennessee, at the Williamson County Medical Center, the hospital there. I'd love to have you if you are in the area. Stop on by. I have a sponsor. He knows he's my sponsor. And important. It's a very important qualification. And I also have the privilege of passing on what was freely given to me to some amazing men, and they call me sponsor. And I also have a relationship with a power greater than myself today that I choose to call God. And all of those things that I just mentioned are indispensable in my life today, and have brought me to a new freedom and something that I get to enjoy each day, in as much as I'm willing to continue to practice the things that I was taught in the very beginning. Didn't really want to accept spiritual help. My first experiences with the spiritual people were going to church as a kid, and I couldn't see what the big deal was about. We were kind of forced into the station wagon and taken there, and you know, it was just suiting up, showing up, punching the time card type of a deal, and it was important because it was important to my parents, and that's what we did. But by the time I was 8 years old, I was starting to experience things that would not jive well with the pastor's message, and so I figured that God didn't want to have anything to do with me. I was on his hit list. So I said, well, if I'm not going to be among the saints, I might as well be amongst the sinners and rise to their ranks and be okay with it. I just kind of push God aside. But ever since I was a child, there was something inside of me that felt apart from. And I don't remember this, but my mom told me several years ago that I came up to her when I was about three, as serious as a three-year-old can be, and told her that I knew that I was adopted and I would like to know where my real family is. And like you, she laughed and we got a chuckle out of it after the fact. And I've done the research and they are who they say they were. And so rest assured, this was just another, story I told myself. And I was riddled by fear and those insecurities and this internal chatter, you know, from as early as I can remember, all the way through my earliest years of going to school. And, I mean, on the outside, I was, you know, one of the guys and liked amongst my peers and had lots of opportunities and had God-given abilities in sports and all of these things. But inside, something was missing. I didn't know what it was. I believe I found it, at least a lesser form of that spirit in the form of Smirnoff vodka the summer going into sixth grade. And me and my buddy found his mom's stash above the washing and dryer machine. The fact that we found it makes me think we had been looking for it for a little bit. You know, just this was a pivotal moment in my life because we ran off into the woods after pouring it into water bottles and a splash of OJ on top, and I started guzzling it, and like that split second after my throat started to, you know, closing up on itself, I thought we might have gotten some cleaner or something that wasn't the right stuff. But then immediately following that, the warmth in that warm fluid flowed from top to bottom and out my toes, and I was sitting in the woods. I could take you back to that same tree right now if it's still there. And it was finally quiet. And that's it. Like, I found it. I found my solution. Like, all of that noise, all of those insecurities, all the fear, all of the apartness, all of that stuff faded. And at 12 years old, I was finally a free man. And would continue to drink that night, whatever was left, you know, in my bottle and whatever he didn't finish. Don't remember feeling too well the next day, but couldn't wait to do it again. And at 12 years old, the resources were slim, but we would take what we could from his parents, take what we could from mine, start to get creative. It wasn't an experience that I could recreate every day, every weekend, but man, I surely couldn't wait to do it again. And so that's what I did. I kind of continued on and stole. And I didn't think about this until getting sober and starting to do inventory and looking at my life, my patterns and behaviors, that I stole my first drink, and actually I stole my last drink, which we'll get to hopefully sooner than later. But I was a thief. We sugarcoat it, like it's cute. And it was when you're 12, you know, and you get slaps on the wrist, you know, up until I started driving, and then it wasn't cute anymore. But I was a thief. And yet I'd steal from people who would just give me anything I'd ask for. Like, so I get through my middle school years and into high school, and that's when things got fun, because I started to drive, like I said, and it didn't take long before I found out that I'd like to travel when I started drinking. And you can only do that for so long until things, you know, the consequences start happening. And so I think I received a DUI when I was 16 or 17. Yeah, I was 17 years old. And I didn't get it the first time. I wrecked my car in, say, like October. And then in December, I borrowed my parents' car without their permission, which, again, is considered theft. And I went downtown, and this is all happening in North Carolina at the time. I'm living there, growing up. And I wake up, I don't wake up, but I come to in the driver's seat with a flashlight coming in. If you've ever seen a flashlight in the side mirror, that's usually not a good thing. They had said that I was going left of center, but I don't remember that. And anyways, I go to jail that night, and I call my house, call my dad. I picked up the phone. It's like 3 in the morning. I said, "Dad, you wouldn't believe what happened." He's like, "I'm sleeping." Click. And I found out that night that I really didn't like the amenities offered in this county jail. They were not plush, and they didn't feed you really well. I was convinced that I did not want to come to jail. So I got out the next day and went home and resolved that I was not going to drive anymore. And the state did well to revoke my license, so I didn't really have the choice to legally do that. And I didn't have a car, and so this is kind of circumstances drove me to come up with a new plan, which was the driving. As a result, I'm 17 now, I'm still under age, and I go to this person, it's called an assessment. And I don't know if you guys have ever been to one of these, but it's like a standardized test for your partying lifestyle. And I'm a smart guy, so I thought, and I was telling them what he needed to hear, so I'd pass the test. And And I failed. I failed. Utterly failed. Or I passed, depending on which side you're on. But he told me that as a result, I had to go to the ANA. And I'm like, well, the ANA, like, God, what is that? But okay. Because I'm the type of alcoholic that will do anything to continue on. I will steal things from you and help you look for them. I will definitely tell you exactly what you need to hear. I will be that guy at that moment, just as long as I know in the back of my mind there's something in it for me. Exactly what the book talks about. Self-centered to the extreme. And so I go to this ANA, and I walk in, church basement. This is in Raleigh. And as soon as I opened the door, I thought that the place might have been on fire because a big plume of smoke came out the door. And I walk in, and it's dark in there, and I can't really see people, but I just walk in, follow the aisle, and there's laughter and talking and all this stuff, and I start to see people's faces, and I'm like, man, these are some old people in here. Like, this, I mean, like, Tales from the Crypt, old, like, coming out, like, this is where they are, and I'm like, they're, all right. But I'll tell you this, they were very nice. You know, they were very kind and polite, just like grandparents. You know, they're just glad you're here. Oh, yeah, I'm sure you are. And I don't remember anything else. They were very nice. I do remember that. And they said, keep coming back. And I said, all right, you know, I'll see you in about 50 years, guys. Like, you just stay off the roads and keep doing this thing. Because in my mind, alcoholics were people who were either very, very old or, you know, just living under the bridge, drinking out of brown paper bags and the things which I would later, you know, come to love. But I had this image of what alcoholism was. I never saw that in my household, and then the generation before me did, you know. And my grandfather, rest in peace, was a horrible hard drinker. I don't know if he was an alcoholic or not, but he did horrible things to the family. And my dad grew up and saw that, and I heard these stories, and they were just like ungodly, something that kids should not have to experience. And that, in my mind, was an alcoholic. But I'm 17 years old. Like, I just got in a little driving incidences a couple times in a row, and I'm certainly can't be an alcoholic. So I would say, thanks for the information, and I'm going to go about my way and do what I do. And I got thrown out of public school. I went to a boarding school. I found things there that, you know, Timothy Leary and all the types of people were interested in, some all the other seekers in another realm. And I found, you know, it was all about the effects for me. Like, I just wanted to be out of the here and the now. And what booze did was it had an ability for a long time to just get me here. And I couldn't find that anywhere else. I was always sober. I was always trying to get there. And there could be anywhere but here. And so I would continually seek this escape. And at some point in that 17 to 19 range, I crossed over that invisible line that we talk about where I lost the ability to choose. I lost the choice in drink. I thought I was the one that was going out for a few or trying to black out. I mean, that's me. I like to black out. I didn't even know that was a thing. But if you've ever started drinking and don't remember stopping drinking, you're like me. That's my experience. I just thought it was the normal, you know, the normal policies and procedures of consumption. Because in that moment, nothing, you know, I'm here and I'm now. And about 19 years old now, I'm in and out of public school. I still haven't even graduated high school. I'm 19. I'm starting to work because I'm thinking, like, money's the solution here. You know, school, it's a waste of time. You know, who cares about that? So I'm making money, and I'm on the outside looking like things, I got it together and everything's good. And I'm snowboarding in the wintertime, traveling. And in the summer and the spring months, I'm living in the mountains now, because at this time, like, I got in so much trouble in the middle part of the state, in the Piedmont area, that they gave me the opportunity to move with my dad, who had taken a new job out west. So I was like, sure, a geographical change to the mountains sounds like a perfect, you know, perfect plan. I found exactly what I was looking for there. Everything I had left, except it was better quality, and so I was just back on my feet. Making money, everything is good. And this one night, I'm out with my roommate at the time, and I'm longboarding down these mountain roads. And it's like 1 o'clock. I've had a couple drinks. I'm not drunk by any means, but I had just enough to try a new route. And I don't remember what happened, but I'm been told that I was going about 10 miles an hour downhill and hit head to concrete after failing to execute a power slide at the end of the hill, and was dead on arrival, pretty much in a bad place. And thankfully, my roommate was there. He was able to, like, run down and call, and they picked me up, rushed me to the hospital, and I can't imagine what that was like as a parent to receive the call at 3 a.m. and saying that, here, you know, there's been an accident. Although I'm sure at that point in time they might have expected. But I'm told they show up to the hospital and they did what they've done consistently my whole life, and they prayed. They prayed to this God that I didn't quite believe wanted anything to do with me. And the neurosurgeon came out and said, look, we're walking into a 72-hour process where we don't know what's going to happen. And they induced me into a coma, and 72 hours have passed, and the neurosurgeon comes out and is like, something has happened here that's not medically explainable. And the brain has went all the way from one side back to almost dead center. And I began like a couple months, I believe, of inpatient therapy, learning how to walk and talk and put my shoes on the right feet. That took a while, and all I wanted was a cigarette. That's all I was saying. Back then I used to smoke, and then like somebody would bum me a cigarette, and I'd have a cigarette in my mouth, and I'd be like walking around. I don't remember any of this, but they don't like you smoking on those floors, and very inconsiderate. But I get out of the hospital, and my roommate picks me up and passed me a flask and one of those medicinal cigarettes that weren't quite legal yet, and without two blinks of an eye, I took a big pull of that flask, and I just went back to it, because I don't have the choice, and it just seemed like a logical thing to do. And now I'm prescribed these things that make high-powered sedatives look like Tylenol, and I'm not having to drink as much. So this is a good deal. Now I'm like, hey, I'm controlling my drinking. Finally. Found how, you know. We talk about it, you know. Have the inability to control and enjoy my drinking. Well, I found out how, but I'll tell you, it's not a sustainable method. And from then until what I pray to be my last drink, I entered some really dark years. And I started to do things that I'd say I'd never do, and those principles that I was taught as a kid slowly began to wither away, and I started to lose who I was, and anybody that was in my way, I would push them out, lie, cheat, and steal just to get what I wanted, to keep the party going. In a last-ditch effort to try and regain some sanity in my life and to get grounded, I was about 21 at the time, and by the time I'm 21, I'm not even able to drink in public. It's gotten that sloppy. I mean, I can start out in public, but it quickly spirals into something that's not it's newsworthy, but it's not something I'd be proud of. So I started ending up in jail and things of this nature. But the one thing I hadn't tried up till now was a relationship. So I figured maybe this would be a good idea. And I was hanging out with some pretty suspicious people, and like they'd only come out during the nighttime, kind of like vampires. We had a good thing, and there was this pretty young lady who had just got out of prison, and I just connected with her like immediately, and I felt like I could trust her naturally. Because she was living in Gotham City like I was at that time, and we were ripping and roaring. It was like Bonnie and Clyde, and it was a spree and remorse. I would start ending up in places that I couldn't get out of regularly, and always going in. With that incomprehensible demoralization feeling, like, God, I'm here again. Like, I had a great family. You know, I had opportunities galore. And here I am, like, sitting with people who are watching TVs that aren't on and stuff like that, you know, and other type of activities. I'm like, gosh, you know, it's real easy for me to look down on them, too. You know, like, oh, I'm they got the wrong guy. But, like, I would have moments of clarity in those places, and then about 12 to 48 hours after I was released, the plan would change, and I would succumb to this obsession that I didn't even know I had. Fast forward, me and Bonnie, we were ripping and roaring, and I crossed over another line and that I'd say I'd never cross, and I did some things that I knew that the state wouldn't be happy about if they find me. So the judge is getting tired. I've had opportunities to drug court and all of these other things. You know, they weren't just going to throw me away and lock. But if you keep showing up enough, they get tired of seeing you. And I knew that I had crossed over that line, and so my plan was, after this last spree, to leave the state and get out of the country. And I needed to get home to get a change of clothes and say goodbye to my mom and my dog, because there was only two beings that would have anything to do with me. And I go and I drive into this, my parents lived at the time in a gated community, and so I punched in the number, and my mom hadn't heard from me in weeks. Lets me in, come in, and there was an undercover sitting down in this little mountain road, and I pull up, just nonchalant, and, you know, like, he grabs his gun and asks me where I've been, and I told him I was just running to the store real quick, and he didn't believe that. Within a matter of seconds, I'm in the back of his car, and I'm looking behind me in the rear, in the car I was in, and there's a dog in the car. It's not my dog. And then there's a row of agents down the road, this little mountain road, and in a gated community. And then here comes my mom pulling up. She'd wonder where I was because it'd been a while now. And then she comes. She's talking with one of the agents, and then drives up. And the look in her face is something I'll never forget, because it reminds me of a mother standing over her son's casket. And I had, by all means, died multiple times over, but spiritually I was dead. Except for this little light inside that was still flickering, and it's the only thing that I can think of that cried out to a God that I'm sure wasn't concerned with me. And I just said, I can't live like this anymore. Please help. And notice, this was the first time I didn't pray to, like, get me out of here. I need out. Because I'll tell you, I didn't get out that day. I didn't get out. But something came over me after I prayed that prayer that I can only explain as God, and it was those people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because by now, you guys had like shown up enough in those sordid places I couldn't get out of that I knew something was working in your lives. It wasn't just a frothy emotional appeal. Your message had depth and weight. And I said, all right, God, if that's what it takes, you know, I'm in. And like I said, I didn't get out on bail, and I wasn't able to go back to my home group and call that sponsor that I never called. But I went back at 23 years old. I get taken to a federal detention facility, and I'm facing 929 months for a series of events that had happened over the last 2 months. And if you're new in sobriety, it's somewhat of a rocky road. I get that. You know, we understand. But I'll tell you, on May 1st of 2008, my plan was to get a change of clothes, to say goodbye to my life and leave the country, because I run when things get bad. But I was rescued on that day. The paper said arrested, but for me it was a day of rescue, and I was taken into a place where I couldn't hurt myself, at least for a short period of time. And I'm here today because a man came to a jail. Now I'm in the beginning. I get sent to this place, this floor where it's 23 hours and 50 minutes a day lockup. Like, I'm sitting in there and not a lot of people to talk to. And it's raw. Things, it's almost like, you know, like this tidal wave. Like, I'm stopping and then all of my life just is like, boom, this tsunami knocks me out. And I get to a floor after that. You know, I get 10 minutes to make a phone call, but I don't have anybody to call. I just sit there at the phone, you know, and just to get out of my cell. And it was a realization that my entire world at that point in time was confined to a room about as big as this stage. And I had nobody to call. But a man came to a jail, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, with his big book in hand, and he came to the jail, and I don't remember a single word that man said, and I met him more than once. But I do remember one thing. He was there when he said he was going to be there. And at the end of the meeting, he got on the elevator and he left, and he went back home to his family. And here I go back to my little concrete abode. And that was an attractive message. He didn't say anything. I share that too because I know that in this room, there's probably some people who are in H&I work or corrections or treatment and take meetings into these facilities. And I share that with you because it's not always what you say. You don't have to have profound things that come out of your mouth to help a man or a woman that's dying inside of a dark and a cold and in a very scary place. So I go and for reasons I don't understand, because I straight up robbed those people my parents. I stole from the people who would have given me anything and had given me everything. So I don't know why, but for probably one of the, you know, that word on the wall, they came up with money that they didn't have and got me a good lawyer, and as a result I got my charges consolidated and reduced and ended up just doing 20 months in the state custody. And that was a frightening experience, to say the least. And I was 23 and going into a place where people who have seasoned convicts and it was just a scary place. If you've been, you understand. If you haven't been, I wouldn't suggest going. However, if you do find yourself in a correctional facility, my experience is it's a fantastic place to get sober. And if you don't have a meeting, get in touch with somebody, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, and make sure that you get one. Because if it wasn't for those men and those women who came in and made that inconvenient sacrifice to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have probably come up with a better plan. Because this disease is alive and well, and inside of a place like that, there is even more the reason to get loaded than there is to stay sober. But I met some people, some other men, who, like myself, suffer from this disease, but didn't have dates, meaning they're never going home. Because in North Carolina, life means life. There's no parole. And these men were walking free. They were walking around with a certain calm about them. Not like the other riffraff that was going along inside there, but they were walking around with principle. And I looked up to that. And I was like, man, if I'm going to survive in here, I need to, you know, it's a very common thing for people to connect with one another. Just like what we were talking about in the first tradition. You know, our common welfare comes first. And I'm so thankful for that group and for those men and for the outside volunteers who had a three legacy group inside. Because and it was as a result of that that I found a sponsor, that I was able to connect with a sponsor. I went out and one of the ways that happened was I was in a horticulture class, because I knew a little something about growing tomatoes in a previous life, and they didn't feed you too well in there. So I was like, well, if I have to grow my own food, then so be it. And that was an incredible experience too, because I had always thought I was really, you know, not the smartest knife in the drawer with school, but I found out something incredible, that if you show up, which you didn't really have a choice not to, and you do the work, you get pretty good grades. And it was in that class and also watching the meetings that I found my first sponsor, and I feel like I owe my life to him and every sponsor that I've had up to this point. I was talking with my buddy Jack, who thanks for coming and supporting today. I feel like all of the sponsors that I've had up to this point have been placed on my path. I think Don last night made a great point that, you know, at 30 days, if I'm going to go out and pick a sponsor, you know, chances are I'm going to pick. I've always had a poor picker in just all things in life, so I'll just leave it at that. But Terry, my first sponsor, was placed on my path, and we used to sit out on the yard, and I would read, he would read, and I would listen, and we'd go through the book, and I was a little bit, I wanted him to understand something one day, and I said, Terry, you know, I can read. I'm, and just like a loving sponsor would say, it's like, I'm sure you can, but you would do better if you take the cotton out of your ears, put it in your mouth, and you listen while I read. And he would continue to read. And it kind of pissed me off, but, you know, it's, I don't know how to live sober. And that's always been my problem. I'd stopped 1,000 times, but stay and stop just baffled me, because there would come a time and a place where I did not have the human power to stop. And Terry was explaining me through this book that was written a long time ago and yet still is so true today, that Matt, time and place will come again, you'll drink without a power greater than yourself. And I was like, that's real cool. And I really wanted to, like, have one of these books so that I could underline things and you know, be one of those big book smarty pants at the meeting and have answers, you know. And boy, I'm fired up, you know. I'm about 6 months in now. I'm ready to go. Ready to take this message to third world countries and cure the world of this alcoholism. But I really like a book to do that. I felt like it would complete the package. And I felt bad asking anything from my parents. Like, you know where I left them. And so I said, Terry, what should I do? And he's like, Matt, there's an address in the back of the big book. Why don't you write them and see what happens? And sure enough, you know, he was spot on, box 459. And I didn't have much else going on, so I wrote a letter to GSO. I didn't know who I was writing a letter to, but that's where it went. And I forgot I even wrote the letter, and a couple weeks later I get a call down to the mailroom, and sure enough there's a package there, and I'm like, wow, that's crazy. And inside the package there was a personal letter written to me. And it says, Dear Matt, your recent letter has come to me as I'm currently serving on the corrections assignment here at the General Service Office. My name is Gail, and I'm an alcoholic, and it is good to have this opportunity to be in touch. Sounds like you've paid a high price for your drinking, and I'm glad to know that you're turning to Alcoholics Anonymous for help. And that day in my world got exponentially bigger, because I realized that Alcoholics Anonymous was bigger than these walls that I was in at this time. That there was actually somebody named Gail outside that cared about me enough to write me a letter and to give me some literature. Wow. It would be several years later, after having the opportunity to be a GSR, that I realized that that is because of a voluntary contribution by the members of a group that decided to send their contributions to GSO, and GSO was able to have literature to send to me sitting in a cell in North Carolina. So if you put a buck or two in the basket in 2007 to 2008, there's a chance. I owe you a thank you. No. But that's how it works, you know? And that's the beautiful thing about this thing. There's so many opportunities to just to give love, to share love. And you don't even have to know where it ends. And it has the ripple effect to change somebody's life and change its trajectory. So me and Terry go through the book, and we get to step eight. And by this time I have a list. We've gone through the inventory. There was one thing on my inventory that I wasn't going to tell him, because I didn't want to spend any more time in prison than I already had. He understood. He said, at the next opportunity to share this with somebody, you share it with them. And I said, that sounds like a plan, boss. And we just kept on going. And by the time I get to step eight, I get to start looking at the harms that I had done. And we go through the list, and I say, now, later, or never. And this is when I'm going to make the amends. And Terry said, now means when I got released, which was fine. That was not long enough. I didn't have to do anything. And it just so happened to be at that time I got moved to another facility. And this is a facility a little bit further east towards the coast, and one that one of my AA heroes, a person I look up to, Tom, I had some influence on, and he definitely is one of those people who has laid down the path before me and so many, and especially in the North Carolina corrections. And I got by the time I got off the bus at this facility, I already had a sponsor. Like, we get the messages, you know, and this was cool to see it actually working for the good. And I had a guy named Juan, and Juan was there, and we went through the first eight steps again, kind of skimmed, you know, make sure that, you know, all the ducks are in a row, the firm foundation is made. And when we got to eight and we looked at my list, he says, now means now. You need to get a piece of paper and a pen. And for those people who are not going to be coming to visit you in person, for you to make a, you know, personal amends, and you need to write a letter. And I was like, yes, sir. And then he showed me exactly in this book. The directions are in black ink. It's amazing. That's why I need a sponsor. Because when I'm new, I'm trying to, like, look, you know, between the black and, you know, pontificate, you know, the deeper meanings of this stuff. It doesn't have to be so. Let's keep this thing simple, you know. Dr. Bob's last message, let's not louse this up. So I had to thank God for sponsorship. And he showed me exactly where in this book that I was supposed to, you know, what I was supposed to say in my amends. And that this isn't a woe is me, I'm sorry, you know, wah, wah, wah. Everybody knew I was sorry. I was a sorry sack, you know, of something. I'd been sorry my whole life. So this is an opportunity for me to set right the wrong. Well, how do I do that? Well, I have to admit the wrong, and then I have to ask them, what can I do to make this right? And so at the top of my list was my parents. My mom wasn't going to come and visit me, so I wrote a letter. And this is a woman who I've done everything to harm except for physically put my hands on her. And I wrote her a letter, and I just said, I'm I haven't been the best son. Send the letter. I forget I sent the letter. A week or two later, I get a response, and basically she just said it was well received, and the one thing that I can do to make this right is for me to love myself like they've loved me this whole time. I think $5,000 would have been easier, it was easier to digest, because I'm losing it. The floodgates open, and about 9 months sober, I'm bawling. And that's not really a cool thing to do when you're in prison, but at this point I didn't care. A few days later, at that same facility, I was actually able to connect with a priest and share that one thing that I said I wasn't going to take to the grave with me. And I'm still very close friends with that man today. He's a friend of Alcoholics Anonymous for sure, and he's helped me as a spiritual advisor and just friend. And if I'm going to tell you something, I need to make sure that we keep in touch and that you don't drift too far away. No, it's love. It's not control. I'm fine. Sounds like an Al-Anon thing, but I walked out onto the yard. And I was startled because I didn't see anybody else, and I didn't see any of the towers, the gun towers, or the fences. I'm standing out on this little knoll, and I'm feel the warmth of the sun come down through me and permeate into my being. And I stand inside of a medium security prison, a free man. I realize that at this point in time, I'm actually free. And the bondage of self had me in chains well before I came into the penitentiary. And I would suggest that for me, the bondage of self is even worse in the free world than it is, doing time inside, in my experience. And the way that I know that is because my mom slept better at night when I was incarcerated, after I got sober, than when I was out there ripping and roaring, waiting for them, waiting to get that call. So I was like, all right, Juan, that's great. That's a great letter. Done crying now. What does this mean? He's like, well, when you go home, you're going to want to be there for her, and at least one day a month, you do something for your mom. I was like, all right, I can file that away. It just so happened that I was able to do that. But fast forward to one of the last camps I was at. I celebrated, my first year inside, and now I'm getting ready to go home. And I go to this facility. And I meet a guy. His name's Bob. He's a beautiful man who would become my sponsor. And he said that I come to prison so I don't come to prison. And I'm like, wow, that's fascinating. Like, tell me more. And you have my attention. And I wanted to get involved in corrections work well before I even got out. And because I had people like Tom I and like Bob and Dean and like my other sponsors who had sponsors outside the walls. And, it was finally time, and I forgot to mention, but while I was still in the beginning of my time, my dad got diagnosed with this rare form of cancer, and they gave him 18 months. Well, I was looking at 20 at the minimum, so that wasn't good. But over the course of time that I was there, we rebuilt our relationship in such a way that I could have never imagined, through letters and through 10-minute phone calls, and just like all of that pain and embarrassment that I had brought on him and on our family, I truly feel like I was able to restore it and was able to, because his condition was declining fast, and he was able to come to one of the facilities I was at, and I was able to make amends directly to him and make it whole, because it wasn't guaranteed that I was going to see him when I got out. But he said that he was going to be there, and against doctor's orders, he was there to pick me up on the day that I got out. And we had to stay in North Carolina for a little bit, because at that time that I was down, he and my mom had moved to Tennessee because he got a new job, and this was like right before he got sick. He got a new job, I'm in North Carolina now. I'm waiting to go to Tennessee, and I'm a little bit nervous because I've built this life in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know without a shadow of a doubt that I need to continue to work the steps and get it plugged in when I got home, because I saw people in the time that I was there, they left, changed their mind, had a new plan, and came back through the system. Like, I know how it works by this time, but self-knowledge isn't enough. You know, faith has to have, has to work through us, but I also need to take some action. So without a shadow of doubt, I'm convinced I need to get plugged into Alcoholics Anonymous. And it is because I was plugged in inside that it was a seamless transition. My Bob said he knew a guy that knew a guy that was in Tennessee. And I was like, gosh, Alcoholics Anonymous is like the mob, you know? They're like, it's like, all right, I'm down. Like, what's going on? Like, what do we do? And I'm thinking that, like, Paulie's going to meet me at the bus station, and we're going to get, the brown paper bag, we're going to get to work. And, if that's what it would have took to, to maintain this way of life, I would have done it in the blink of an eye. But nobody's ever asked me to hurt anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have hurt people in Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm selfish and self-centered. But that'll be another talk for another day. What happened is I experienced the breadth of the fellowship and the scope that, we are everywhere. And when I touched down in Nashville, 2010, there's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous there waiting for me, looking forward to welcome me in. And his name was Scott L. And, Scott's my sponsor now. I love him dearly. And when I got there, he wrapped me in his arms. And I just got out of prison. Like, I almost dropped him for a second. Like, I didn't. And he wouldn't let go. I was just expecting one of those hugs. And he just, like, held on. And I'm like, oh, man, what's about to happen here? Like, this is not cool, man. I've survived. I survived prison. I didn't think that I was going to have to be a victim in the free world, but I love that man, and seriously, he welcomed me into Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, I hope and pray that I can and do to other men and women for that matter, but he gave me the proper welcome. And Bob told me it was important to get a sponsor, get a home group, get a commitment. These are big things for him. And so I did. I went to my home group. At the time, it was a noon meeting, and he said, I was like, how do I get involved? How do I get a commitment? He says, well, you look for the old timer in the room and you ask them, how can I be of service? It's like, okay. So I was scoping out the meeting, and there's this guy, Detroit Dave, who'd always just kind of sat at the old timer table. And I was like, all right, I'm going to, go up to Detroit, and I go say, hey, Dave, I need to get involved in service. And he looked at the guy next to him, looked back at me, and they started laughing. I was like, I don't know what's so funny here. My life's on the line, And what'd Bob ask me to ask this guy? And he's like, oh, you want to get involved in service? That's great. Come to the business meeting on Thursday. And I was like, all right, cool. I don't know what kind of business we're talking about, but I was like, all for the good of AA, let's do it. And I left that meeting, the GSR. Had no idea what a GSR meant, what that even was. And same thing happened at a young people's meeting. I went to a young person's meeting because I was like, hey, I'm young. I should probably check that out. And I didn't realize it was a Tikipa bid committee meeting, and I ended up leaving a treasurer, and I don't even know. It's like, so be careful if you guys go to meetings, you know, be ready. But I'll tell you what, that's where the fun is in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because as a result of becoming the GSR for my home group, they paid for me to go to an assembly, and that's the whole state of Tennessee. And within a very short time of being, you know, moving from North Carolina to Tennessee, I had family from Knoxville to Memphis. Just like that. Just because I showed up. And I said, my name's Matt. I'm an alcoholic. And I was really interested in corrections, like I said. And so I went to the corrections committee. And I told them, I was like, hey, my name's Matt. I just got out of prison. And I'd like to be involved. And they're like, well, we're really glad you're here. And, you know, I ended up being the treasurer for the area. And I'm like, guys, do you know who I am? Like, I told you where I just came from. And you're giving me the checkbook. It's like, I still don't have a checkbook yet. Are you sure you want to give me a checkbook? I think they knew exactly who I was. And it's that love, that reckless love that exudes through members of Alcoholics Anonymous that made me feel like I was one of you guys. And I'm going to tell you what, that balance was right on to the penny. Because, you know, like, if a dime was missing, they were coming after me, and I don't want my probation officer to know. And I was on paper at the time. And my experience with that is that, like, you know, by being honest and being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, probation wasn't as difficult as I remember it when I was trying to arrange the show myself. And at this time, my dad's not doing well. You know, I don't think he's going to make it to my 2-year anniversary. So I went to get my 1-year chip from my my home group now. And I sat on the couch with him one night and I said, hey, Pops, I want to give you something. And he looked at it like it was a 50-carat diamond. He knew exactly what it was. And he said, wow, I'm so proud of you. This is amazing. And I don't think he knew any of you, but he loved each and every one of you. Because you gave him his son back. And shortly thereafter, he went on to the next chapter, and I was able to be there, like, present for my mom, my little sister, and for the family, who a lot of them just come around during funerals, but that's another family dynamic that I've come to love too, because I can be there today. I can be present. The old me. They said, Matt, the old man will drink again. And I was thankful at the time because I was young. I said, well, I got some time, you know. But they said, the old Matt will drink again. The old Matt runs from pain. He runs from that. You guys have shown me how to suit up and show up in a way that is indeed remarkable. Since my dad passed, you know, I've been able to give my mom my medallion each year. And this past... this past year, it's 15, and more than anything she wanted on Mother's Day, it was that 15-year medallion. And we have an incredible relationship today. My sister, shortly after my dad passed, got married, and she asked me to walk her down the aisle, and I hadn't been to weddings too much because of obvious reasons. People wanted to have order, and so I had to ask around to some people in AA, like, what do you do at weddings, you know? And they're like, but what an incredible experience, you know, and I almost missed it. Before my dad passed, I had this idea, like, I was driving down the road and I saw a sign that said, spring semester classes, sign up now. And I was like, wow, interesting. Maybe I wasn't working at the time. Maybe I should sign up and try to go to school. And so I tried that. I only signed up for 2 classes because if I'm going to fail, I want to, you know, just minimize the damage and the expense. But something incredible happened. I applied the principles that I learned through coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, specifically those that I learned in business meetings and the traditions. And I was able to excel at school. So much so that by the second semester, they had nominated me into an honors program. And I went in through this honors program. I graduated. If you show up long enough for extended periods of time, they kick you out with a degree eventually. Never got that far. Because I'm like a lot of you guys. I'm great out of the gates. You know, I'm great out of the gates. Never could finish. And after that two-year degree, I got transferred into a four-year private school in Nashville, and I was able to get a bachelor's of business. And in my final semester, I was going through a really dark time, personal relationships, you know, kaput. And I was at a second jumping-off place, sober. I was so close to checking myself into a hospital for my own safety. I didn't want to drink, but I just couldn't stand what had become of my life. This is sobriety? I'm 6 years sober. And I just kept putting one foot in front of the other, and I had a new experience, a new surrender. My God got a lot bigger. I realized that I had, even at that point in time, had put God in a box. My God works better outside of a box, through you, through being in the present. And I had been recommended and received a scholarship to take a master's program in France. Now, that's Paris, France, like France, France. I don't speak French. And I'm certain, like, if you knew who I was, that you wouldn't let me leave the country. And if you did, you might not let me back in. So I had a lot of fear around that, just like I have with a lot of things that have come up in my life. And I remember something that I heard Tom say a while back. He says, Matt, the guards have the keys, but God opens and closes the gates. And so I realize here I've been taught in Alcoholics Anonymous that I'm not in charge of outcomes. All I have to do is take the actions. Leave that to God. He's better equipped. And so that's what I did. And I went down to Atlanta. I went to the magistrate's office there. I signed some paperwork. I was honest. Just as honest. I answered the questions they asked me. You know, it's important. And I left that office with a student visa, and I went to another office. I honestly answered some questions, and I left with a passport. And within 3 months from getting this opportunity, I'm in a big plane crossing a big lake, going to a country that I don't speak the native language, but I heard that they have AA in France. So as long as I can find you guys, as long as I can tap into you and I bring God with me, I can go anywhere. And so I was able to spend just under 2 years in France and had an incredible experience. Had some moments there, too, where I was really, you know, it's like I had this map. You know, by this time I was the DCM in my district. I was like alternate chair at the area. Like I had this map of what had been working in Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. And now I'm on new soil. Things are done differently over there. But I found that the principles are the same. And I found some other expats there, and we had a big book study, just three guys every month. We would study a step, and then we'd talk about it. And then I'd attended a beginner's meeting at the American Cathedral in Paris. I took a two-hour train ride every Saturday morning to a meeting with English-speaking people from all over the world. And here I am. I'm walking down the streets one day, cobblestone streets in Paris, and I'm just, tears are coming to my eyes because I don't know how I got there. In 7 years, I go from a box, concrete, to walk in the world a free man. And that's thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous. I come home and reunite with my wife, which is just another divine intervention of second chances. But I had some opportunities to start, like, speaking. And in a few years back, before the pandemic, I was in Syracuse giving a talk on Sunday morning, just like this. And after the meeting, it's customary for people to come and shake your hand, give you hugs and stuff. No pressure. But they, a gentleman came up to me, and he's like, did you say that it was Gail was the name of the lady from GSO? And I said, yes, sir, that's the one. And he says, hold on 1 second. And he pulls out his phone, and he puts Gail on the phone from GSO. And now, 10 years later, I was able to thank, and I'm sobbing, too, because I'm like, you know, you don't have no idea. She's like, oh, no, it's okay. But I've had these moments, these full circle moments through the course of time where I've been able to thank the people who have meant so much to me. Scott, my sponsor, invited me to the usual, it's a men's conference, and it's usual suspects. I'll put it out there. The year I got out, and Tom was one of the moderators that year, Tom I, and I got to have dinner with him one night, just the two of us, just me and Tom. At the end of the conference, I brought him my 12 and 12, which I'd carried with me through my time. Inside, I had my state number on it and everything, and Tom opens up the book, and he says something, and then he writes his number, and he crosses the line through it, and he says, "I don't wear this anymore." Wow. My world got exponentially bigger that day, too. And through this whole process, you know, I think the guys that I sponsor have helped me out tremendously more than I've been able to help them, and I've seen them walk through some things that are just incredible. I'm often the last one to see the miracle happening in my life, and so I need you. I need to see the newcomer, you know, light up, you know, when things happen, and I've been able to go back to a lot of the prisons that I've been to as a resident and carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been able to come and hang out with people. I mean, I live a life beyond what I feel like I deserve. And I used to say that. I was one of those guys, "Oh, I'm doing better than I deserve." And then I had somebody come up to me after the meeting who I respect, and it's like, "Matt, who are you to tell God what you deserve?" Well, all right. I won't be saying that again. And it's true. Who am I to tell God what I deserve? I wish every one of you just an incredible experience. I've fallen on my face in sobriety, and I've also had some incredible moments. And I wouldn't trade it for the world, because I'm here. I'm present. And if this guy, you know, can put together one day at a time, you know, I believe that anybody can. And I truly wish you the best on your journey. And thanks again for the opportunity to spend the weekend with y'all.